two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Something came across our desk the other day, and it wasn't a lot of conversation around it, probably because it's over in the continent. And whereas everybody around the world usually is very good at digging deep into world affairs, we tend to highlight what was going on at the Met Gala and, you know, and whether or not, you know, Clay is going to get back with Megan. You know, those types of things are the stories du jour. But this one was really important, and it talked about the Trump administration basically threatening the government of Zambia. And they're saying, look, if you want money for AIDS, then you're going to have to give up your mineral rights. And, you know, it was just said matter-of-factly, there was nothing else to it, but it seemed like business as usual, and that's what we do. And so I wanted to dig deep into that, and I couldn't think of a better person than our guest, Nefta Friedman, the longtime political organizer, Pan-Africanist, and he's based in Washington, D.C., and he's part of the coordinating committee for the Black Alliance for Peace. And he's also on our sister station in D.C., WPFW. So, Nefta, thank you for joining us this afternoon. And were you surprised when you saw those headlines? Mm-hmm. Or did you say to yourself, well, it's probably business as usual, at least for this administration?
Right. Well, thanks for having me on again. Yes, par for the course is the first thing, you know, and it was interesting because this is seems to have resulted or culminated into a tension between Zambia, the Zambian government and the U.S. government, where the ambassador, I'm forgetting his name, Gonzalez is his last name. I can't remember his name right now, was they were in a little standoff in the media and in the public where the U.S. ambassador, and I guess the U.S. in general, is denying the claim that this kind of a quid pro quo type of arrangement is was being pursued with Zambia. But we already know that that's been actually what they've been doing around Africa, this particular thing. We know it's in Kenya. We know Zimbabwe was concerned with it. And this whole thing has emerged where it's kind of like the new pursuit, the new policy with Africa. It comes out of the strategic emergence of the strategic strategy adopted this year, particularly around Africa, shifting foreign assistance from the humanitarian endeavors, or, you know, framed as some more altruistic thing to much more blatant and, overt transactional America first approach that, you know, this right. Trump administration has. And the model conditions funding for health, like you said, services like for HIV and AIDS treatment and other things on securing mineral concessions. And that's what the Zambian government is accusing and seems to be validated, accusing the U.S. of doing, of coupling their aid or conditioning the aid that now Africa has become pretty dependent on, you know, and it used to also be administered mostly by the USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development, that this administration dismantled. And that now they put these, you know, their thing is, okay, instead of us just, quote unquote, giving out the aid for free and without getting anything in return, they're going to make deals around minerals.
I appreciate you giving us the breakdown of that. Few things come to mind. First, where's Zambia? Let's get a little bit of Zambia 101. I think most people aren't very familiar, couldn't point it out on the map. Why is it important, you know, and in an increasing environment where Even black folks, I shouldn't say even, there are some very loud folks who have taken a xenophobic position themselves, where they're going, "Why we hate? Why are we helping Africa? What have they done for us?" So, what do we need to know about Zambia?
So Zambia is kind of more, it's a little bit, it's Central Africa. It would be considered what we used to call it the one of the frontline states. It borders the Angola, Zaire, Zimbabwe, and I mean that's just a couple of them. I think Congo is one of the bordering states. Yes, Congo, and so it used to be Northern Rhodesia. It used to be part of Rhodesia. So Zimbabwe and Zambia were. Zambia was Northern Rhodesia, and Zimbabwe was Southern Rhodesia,
And it's
and
important to note, not to cut you off, that
then,
these were borders that came out of that conference,
that's right.
in Belgium, where they divided up Africa without Africans being able to participate. So it's like if I just come to your house and say, this is Davy D's house and the Freeman house is over there, and it's like, well, what happened?
Right. And they just kind of chopped up Africa based on their own, so they wouldn't have to fight with each other over it. They came together to say, well, let's make a, let's divide up the spoils of our thing. And so as a result, Zambia came out of that. And that it became, well, Northern Rhodesia came out of that, is what they, and then Zambia, after getting its independence in 1964, they had a liberation struggle, and they got their independence in 1964. Revolutionary government led by Kenneth Kaunda and his party, Socialist Party, and they also assisted a lot of the other countries trying to get their independence. But anyway, that's the backstory. So people have to understand a lot of all the countries that we know of today, as you pointed out, are products of colonialism, but also the emerging out of the struggle against colonialism and for independence. And that a lot of the ones with the frontline states had to engage in armed struggle to get their independence, actually, where, and that they were also apartheid, settler colonial states. It was a settler colony where the Europeans came and actually lived and settled there, not just, ruling from afar with the mother country metropole. They actually claimed independence as a separate nation, like South Africa and whatnot. That was Zambia's history, and then Zimbabwe's history, and others, Namibia and whatnot. And
So
that,
basically, people were being ruled and literally enslaved in their own
right,
country.
exactly, and by ruling, and so, and then having to wage a struggle around that. And so, as we know, also all of Africa, whether it was a settler colonial project or not, and the settler colonialism was in different places on the African continent, and that whether settler colonialism or not, it was an exploitative relationship, and it benefited the West in general, or the Western countries, mostly we can see, embodied with through NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, that still depends on the plunder and the exploitation of Africa, and so there's no bilateral relationship. Africa, and particularly, let's go back to Zambia in particular, it is most of its export. I think almost 70% of its economy, it depends on extraction of minerals, of metals, particularly copper in this instance. And so what we're seeing here is, and copper, and people got to understand the significance of copper right now in the global economy, is one of those things that is the new considered the new oil, as they call it, because of its indispensable role in the global energy transition from, like, AI and data centers, which is, you people probably hearing a lot about data centers right now. So copper is instrumental. It's one of the main metals for that. So I hope that brings us back from kind of a historical context to now. What we're dealing with are neocolonial arrangements. So all of the old formal classic colonialism of, settler colonialism and rule and that kind of thing has been circumvented for a new forms of colonialism, where all of your politics and economy is really still tied by outside, but you have all the trappings of independence. You have a black president, somebody indigenous, all that kind of stuff, but you're still beholden to the global economy. And in this instance, The U.S. and Zambia are in a standoff, or seeming to be, not really. I wouldn't know if I would call it a standoff, but trying to contend around what the relationship will be for extracting minerals and other kind of things, in return for the kind of aid that now has come to characterize the paternalistic aid that characterizes the Western governments toward Africa, a lot of the world.
Nefta, let me ask you this. Nefta Friedman is our guest, talking about the Trump policy toward Zambia and the demand for minerals in exchange for money to fight AIDS. I think when people hear that headline, it conjures up an image that says, well, why can't they just do for themselves? And why is Zambia dependent upon the US, and what is wrong with the government, et cetera, et cetera. And it paints a picture of inferior people. And we hear the same story over and over again with various countries in the continent. Maybe you could kind of shed some light on that a bit, because from my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this, it seems like there's a little bit of gaslighting going on. It's kind of like the reason why I'm dependent upon you is because money that I would have wanted and resources that I would have wanted in exchange for my independence have been caught up in world banks and other things like that. Other situations we caused, like when you look what goes on in Central and South America, US comes in, installs governments, and then looks at the people crazy when they are, destitute. So in the case of Africa not having humanitarian aid, is this a byproduct of ineptness of the governments there, or resources and things just tied up, making it literally impossible for people to move and shake the way that they ideally need to do, because of prior conditions that have been put on the country?
Wow, brother, you asking me like a thesis question up here. So I'll do my best. Well, I think the first thing, if I can recommend a book too, the people, it's the classic book. I know you heard of Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And that people should kind of understand that, and understand that the global arrangement, that the arrangement that is exists now, and it's really not just Africa, but a lot of the global, we call refer to the global South countries, but Africa is very pivotal in this, comes out is born out of the domination and plunder that former colonialism, classic colonialism had, the colonizing countries and everything by force and whatnot, and that and during that time, an economic order was established that was extractive in nature. This was done by force, and that over the centuries, where the global South countries, and particularly Africa, where we would refer to what's called cash crops, and extractive things like oil and diamonds and all these kind of mining, these kind of things, was what enriched the Western countries. And United States kind of gets away without being even seen as, but it has a hand in that as well. Maybe it's a little latecomer. And so not only enriched it, it also made them very powerful. They've been able to amass and strengthen their militaries for domination. And this is the beginning of the dominating relationship. Fast forward past to after countries, and people rising up, because that's what really happens, that people are not, no one ever just submits to their colonization. There's always resistance, right? And there's always those who are conscious enough to organize the most radical resistance. And that's what gave was contributed to or created the independence movements and the decolonialism colonization movements across Africa. You could see in Africa, there it, we even went as far as to calling for, and I say we because I identify with Africa more than I identify with the U.S. like Malcolm, is that we called for a United States of Africa, and really realizing that that there could be no real true independence and self-determination and liberation for the continent of Africa without all of these micro states created by imperialism, you know, now created by for them to kind of unite and erase these borders and consolidate an economy and a political structure, really first a political structure. And then, you know, as Nkrumah told us, seek ye first the political kingdom and then your policy set the economic structure. However, the as we adapted and tried to get our independence, so too did the enemy. They could see things. They have, you know, intelligence and all this kind of stuff that the traitors of our people could even, you know, send them things and infiltrate our movements and whatnot. And so there was always, like you said in your opening to this, then you have the placating of the independence movements, because people may not have all the complete revolutionary consciousness and even hindsight to know what they were up to, granting independence, but still maneuvering to figure out how do we tie, because, you know, don't forget, we had a global economy set up with the IMF and the World Bank, all the, you know, the supply chains and the routes and the corporations and countries now dependent on cash crops and extraction. Their economies are dependent on that. So for them to, you know, for us to transform, get away from that and establish economies that were really based on the needs of the people and not based on exploitation, that was a taller order. And that was undermined and has always been undermined at every turn ever since colonization. And so it's not like we're not, people are not inferior, you know, or just dependent because we want to be. It takes a long time. It takes, you know, to get out of this. And that also, our enemy, you know, finds ways, and I say our enemy, you know, those who are, you know, wedded and dependent and want exploitation of human beings by human beings and the planet, you know, and that whoever, institutions, all that, that they also find ways to keep, you know, us down. Like you said, there's assassination of leaders, there's all kind of things, invasion, they'll invade you, you know.
Right. Well, I think one of the things we should take heed to is when you say assassination of leaders and things like that as it pertains to Africa, it seems so far away. I can't really wrap my head around enough to, you know, just, you know, it's like, yeah, that was then, this is now. But we're seeing the brutality of it right now. We're seeing what's happening in Venezuela. We're seeing the kidnapping of a president. And we're seeing, to your point, a country, in this case, we're talking about Iran, who goes, yeah, I got a lot of oil. And the U.S. saying, well, we will prevent that oil from coming to you. And same thing in Venezuela. Well, we got a lot of oil. And the U.S. saying, yeah, but we won't let it go to Cuba. We'll starve them to death. And so the question that I put now with respect to that is, it seems like Africa has been dealing with that for a very long time as well. It's just not seen, as I said at the beginning of the show. So we can't wrap our heads around it. Like, we're upset about the boats being, you know, bombed and people killed in Venezuela, as we should. But similar types of force has happened with our, you know, with the on the continent. Which brings me to this question. We're looking at Trump and he's the devil of the day. And I'm saying that, you know, intentionally. One would think that there would have been significant progress made under Biden and under Obama around these policies of Africa. And so is Trump reversing the clock with respect to their policies, or is he building on groundwork that they laid out? And I'm asking this understanding Obama's role in setting up AFRICOM and increasing those military bases throughout the continent.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's part of the answer too that I was getting at. Part of it is proliferation of the military footprint across the continent. And it's actually not just the continent of Africa, but the continent of Africa is much more stark. It's all over. They have what the U.S. command, military command centers all around. There's about 11 of them. But AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command, is all over the continent, you know, and that now, just now. And yes, and let me just start with AFRICOM, because you mentioned AFRICOM, which was birthed in 2008, the birth, the first in two, maybe even 2000. 2007 a little bit with Bush administration, but really gaining steam in 2008 when the Obama administration came into play and then was able to kind of spread across the continent. Now we've seen gains actually, and people should be aware of this and actually expelling AFRICOM, and expelling even the French, because it's not just AFRICOM in the US, it's the NATO forces, France, Britain, US, all these, Italy, and all these forces that were NATO. France and the US had the biggest military footprint across France, because a lot of the Francophone, what they call Francophone countries. And that these countries, particularly if we're going to point to prime examples of anti-imperialist projects in Africa that should give us inspiration, are Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso forming the Confederation of Sahel States, or the Alliance of Sahel States that has ousted AFRICOM and the French. And which we're kind of seeing, this is what part of the moves right now is the desperation to kind of regain this unilateral paternalistic position that they benefit from, that they depend on. And so AFRICOM, like you said, is spread across the continent. It's a military, thing. It has also claims and positions itself to be the remedy for the terrorism that is across the country, right? I mean, across the continent, that not all over the continent, but in key places where that they actually created this, And so, I might have lost the essence of your original question.
Well, we were looking at whether or not Trump was a step
Yes,
backwards, or
right.
was he just building off of the foundation laid by Obama and then Biden?
He definitely building off of the, and this is interesting you asked me, and it made me think of another. He's building off of the foundation laid by Obama and then Biden. Trump two Trump 1.0 was interesting. I don't think that this megalomaniac understood the role that imperialism, that the dependency that imperialism has on the African continent and on AFRICOM in general, because he actually diminished, kind of roll scaled back AFRICOM. He even took the forces out of Somalia to some extent, that actually can do their biggest foot. I mean, a big footprint is in Somalia, drone bombing and everything. That was the Trump 1.0, and then that was interrupted with the Biden administration, who put them back in. Right now, we knew, and I could see that because Trump and his sort of he campaigned on trying to bring take the not have the military everywhere and all this kind of stuff and stopping the wars or whatnot, but not because he was altruistic or anything like that, because he just I don't know, he just giving campaign promises, but because he's part of that class, had to eventually realize, and it's not all about Trump. The establishment realizes they depend on this military domination. The military and the defense it's an industry in and of itself, and a lot of this extractive stuff with copper and all these other minerals, cobalt, coltan, and uranium are feed that industry directly, and not to mention other industries with all the electronics. So it was only for so Trump 2.0 understood this now. Now they learn from their past, and now they're trying to continue what they pick up their lessons, and re what really the role that the West plays in the global economy is about domination and full spectrum dominance. And now he's doing it much more blatantly with the strong arming and calling it, saying the quiet parts out loud, their administration. But it's not really anything different. I think it's much more blatant. And in some ways, that may be doing us a favor, because it's making, like we can see in instance for Zambia, for example, where because it's more blatant, it's making what would be willing compradors and willing agents of imperialism kind of stand up a little bit and say, particularly because their people want them to stand up.
Nestor Freeman is our guest out of our sister station, WPFW in DC. Also, longtime Pan-Africanist and also down with the Black Alliance for Peace, talking about the Trump administration and the strong arming of Zambia. You mentioned this a couple of times that I want to build on this a little more. The use of copper. And as you said, cobalt and coltan and all those things. I always remind people of our collective complicity when we insist that people take certain positions against genocide and things like that, and I agree with that, but we also have to wrestle with our own contradictions, including us as we're sitting here probably on some sort of electronic device and things like that that has come at the hands of some form of genocide in Congo and places like that. So that needs to be said, and we need to wrestle with that contradiction. Some people justify it, say, I don't have any other way to talk to you. We need these phones. We need these computers. I get that. But let's just be clear, that we're in the swamp and that we're not away from it. What concerns me now is with the spread of artificial intelligence and how you said these minerals now take on heightened importance. That now you have your Elon Musk and, and your Sam Altmans and all these folks that are looking not only to get the minerals, but also to set up data centers in the continent and pollute their water and pollute their air and pollute their people. And most folks figure that if me and you are Chat GPT, that we're diminishing the water supply, and we forget that 95% of what the AI stuff is used for is military stuff. So it's a whole other ball
Right.
game. We're minuscule compared to what it's really being used for. So my concern now is that we're looking at the continent with fresh new eyes and fresh new needs and with a new strategy. Maybe it gets divided up even more. Maybe we're going to be further entrenched. Maybe we will, as you said, do more than say the quiet parts out loud, but actually just say, we're going to take Zambia is going to be part of the US, just like we were in Iceland or Greenland. You know what I mean? I could see those sorts of things happening because the battle, too, is what is Russia going to do? What's Israel's role in some of this? Where's China at on all this? So, how do we kind of parse some of that out?
Well, that's an important question. The first thing I would encourage us to do, like people listening that kind of are at least on our side of this, that actually don't really have the ultimate stakes in the game, is to not identify with those who do. I'm going to have to refer to like Malcolm X, and say that, we have to begin to see ourselves as, especially those, because we, a lot of us in this country, we're oppressed and repressed by these same forces. And
Right.
so I think that when we begin to realize that we have an interest, our interests are bound up with the interest of the rest of the, formerly colonized and now currently neo-colonized world, and that we are racks actually, that then when we bind up that we have that same interest, then we will wage and behave like we have something at stake to kind of dismantle and stop what's this current trajectory of the US in the West. The United States, in terms of the rulers, they identify with Western Europe. It's an extension of Western Europe. NATO, and we got to see things in the sense of it's the global South, the rest of all of collective humanity against these NATO forces. And once we start looking at that this way, then we also begin to look at other powers in the world like Russia and China differently, right? We don't have to be, we don't begin to think that our interests are served by kind of the same effort, the same intent to undermine the interests of Russia and China the way the United States does, the way that the powers that be, that doesn't help us, In fact, I think if we were to look at what's happening on the continent of Africa and the role of Russia and China, it's not like it's not the role of like France and the United States. It's not the role. They did not destroy Libya, while they may not have done anything to stop it, they didn't destroy Libya and contribute to the proliferation of all of these terrorist formations and the arms across the Sahel and whatnot. And then right now, if you were to ask the countries of the Alliance of Sahel States, they would say it's Russia that's helping them, beat back all of these kind of interests, and that they suspect that the French in particular, and we can even, and we already know that the proxy, Ukraine proxy, the Nazi white supremacist in Ukraine, which is a US proxy, has helped in Mali to undermine, you know, and that these, that they suspect that they're assisting these terrorists covertly, you know, because they don't want that project to succeed. They can't, you know, the West depends on the destabilization of Africa. It depends on the destabilization of the global South and for turmoil and whatnot. And so, and that's nothing that benefits the, you know, common people within the United States. You know, we don't benefit from that. And in fact, our communities, if we go, and we've been on your show before talking about this, our communities are plagued by, you know, the same, the militaristic forces domestically, you know, just beating us up in our communities, trying to control and contain us. These are the same forces. We got to think of it that way. And I think once we start thinking of that, you know, it's not to say that China and Russia are some, you know, perfect saviors, and that's not even what I'm talking about. I'm saying that we, you know, we have a different interest, and once we do that, we kind of pursue our advancement, our future in a different manner.
You know, if we kind of wrap up, I'm thinking we often talk about Western powers, Russia included, talk about China. Where do the Arab state stand on all this? Many Arab states have been responsible for enslaving Africans, even as we speak, in the destruction of Libya. On Obama's watch, it was those forces that we were fighting that wound up enslaving folks, you know, on his watch, right? And so, how do we parse out the Arab contribution? Because on one hand, we're looking and we're seeing, and we say, you know, Free Palestine, and we understand we don't want genocide and all that, but there have been folks in other countries that have been very anti-black, very anti-African, and even had disagreements with Gaddafi when he was trying to, you know, unite and really get all of Africa under one umbrella. So how do we kind of parse that out? And Israel and Arab states, they seem like wild cards in, you know, this tension in this battle.
I think one thing is we gotta, if we're applying what I would maybe call a class analysis, that every peoples has people who are opting for, you know, the forces that are about exploiting and dominating, you know, having that with being the prevailing order in humanity, and then those who are for the liberation of people. Every people has that. So we don't want to make the mistake of every of all, you know, of condemning all. And we can see it if we understand it, you know, because like you referred to Libya, Muammar Gaddafi wasn't no anti-African. He was pan-Africanist, right? And then it's not, we're not just talking about one individual. We're talking about groups of, you know, Libyans who can identify with Africa, just like there were groups of Libyans that wanted to help the United States overthrow them, right? They are Cubans that identify with the Cuban Revolution and helped in the in liberation of Africa. Then those what we, a lot of people call the Gusanos that want to help the United States and overthrow the Cuban Revolution and are racist, really racist, you know. If we look at some of the states like Yemen, you know, and Iran is not a Arab country, but Persian, but you know, it's there are those that opt and Palestinians. There are Palestinians, and the Palestinians in general are not anti-African, you know, and understand that there's there is a lot of ties between our liberation struggles. Although you will find it's not hard to find confused people that may confuse Palestinians, just like you can find confused Africans and confused Black people about, you know, how we, the disposition that the race, the implications of so-called race in our people, you know. And so we have to be able to distinguish, make a difference between an ideological and mentality and principled, you know, contradictions, these issues, and not mistaking them to characterize a whole people. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely does make sense, and it requires us to really up our political education. We
That's
can't
right.
make sweeping
That's right.
statements. Otherwise, those can be used on us. And I
Because
often tell people, when you travel, You got to remember what the calling card is for black folks around the world. It used to be Malcolm and Martin and the struggle, but now
Right.
the calling card is what they showed, proverbially on the BETs. As I found
Right.
when I've been to places like, when I was going to, oh gosh, what's the place that we're talking? Lebanon, right?
Lebanon.
Right. When I was in places like that, people are like, hey, man, what's going on with you guys? Like, what are you talking about? And, their analysis is drawn from what is being shown on TV and what's being hoisted on
Right.
radio. And so there's these stereotypes that people see and say, well, you guys have a lot of money. I see you throwing money at the TV. How come you don't, in the videos? How come you don't own TV stations? Things like that. And you have to explain, well, that's not us. That's, we're another group of
Imagery.
people. We're freedom fighters. And so I think to your point, yeah, that absolutely does make sense. And it requires us to dig deep and know that there's a difference. There are folks for liberation, and there are folks, as you say, that are the equivalent to the Compadre class. Just like we
That's
got
right.
Negroes here that are talking about, I support Trump because he's going to bash on Haitians, Jamaicans, and Pan-Africans.
Right.
You become an enemy for just your conversation, versus being seen as a freedom fighter. And many of those folks would have dragged Malcolm, to his
Right,
death
that's right.
and would have opposed Marcus Garvey and all that, because they too are cuddling up literally for money with
Right.
this administration. And so they're part of that collaboration class.
And it's interesting that the example you said, well, they can see these imagery, people throwing money at the screen, and we could, if we coupled that, because you said, well, that's just, imagery, that's propaganda in a lot of ways, even though it's a music, it's propaganda. If we also point it out to them, because they know they can identify with it, if they say, they always telling us y'all terrorists. It's the same thing. And then people are like, oh, and then the light bulb goes off. It's like, I hear you, okay. That kind of thing. And so, yeah, when we
Which
see.
is the conversation I had in Lebanon, in Beirut. It's like, yeah, you believe that. Let me tell you what we're seeing. And then it's
Exactly.
and it's a come to Jesus moment
Right,
for
exactly. And then so
everybody.
that we have these states like the UAE, United Arab Emirates, like Saudi Arabia and whatnot, and that they don't represent their people. So people got to remember, you can't think, oh, the Saudi Arabia and the Arabs, look what they're doing. That's not the Arabs. That's the class, the royal class, close to the royal class of Saudi Arabia, who's unpopular, in their country, and it's the same with the UAE. And so in Kuwait and all these countries, so we can't, we have to, yeah. This, like you said, it's about political education, so we can impart some critical analysis, Robbie.
As we wrap up, what do you want us to do? What levers can we push to turn things around in Zambia, and really support, to make sure that, first of all, they get the aid that they need, and two, to stop this type of demand, because it ain't going to stop with Zambia, but I think it's going to carry over to all these other African countries, and also Israel, because I was disturbed. We have to do a whole show on them wanting to, set doing a settlement in Nairobi or out or in Kenya. And I was like, what the heck? So
Yeah,
that's a
I'm on
country to
my
keep
way
our
to
ear.
we're on our way to Nairobi this week to for the summit, the
Oh, okay.
Pan-Africanism summit against imperialism. And so it's a mirroring the Africa, the France summit, France Africa summit that they have, Africa Forward that they're having at the same time. So it's a counter summit. But like you said, it's about NATO. It's not just about France. It's like NATO, including the Israel and those moves. Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that, if we can.
Yeah.
I'd
Well, we'll
appreciate
have you come back, and especially after you get back from the conference. That's a
it.
whole thing unto itself. But as we let you go, what's our marching orders, Nefta?
So, I mean, one thing is that we should be, it's African Liberation Day coming up. May 25th is the official African Liberation Day. People should tap into the struggle, a more radical and revolutionary disposition around Africa. We should not. So when it comes to Zambia, while the high profile ones who are standing seem to be standing up against the United States, That's not, you know, we need to be looking at the revolutionary forces in the country, the ones calling for socialism and for the use of the minerals and everything, and to re and the rejection of U.S. aid, trying to figure out how do we do things for ourselves and whatnot, along the lines of the Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger and other, you know, and so we need to look to those forces and get analysis from there and understand that, you know, the actual genuine struggles on the ground in Zambia will be, you know, that's we're not going to see that reflected in the media. We're just going to see these high profile stuff, and that goes for every country in Africa. And so I think that's the first thing we got to do in terms of ed politically educating ourselves, and then joining an organization. This about, you know, make tying these connections across continental, transcontinentally, and then struggling, you know, to free our people.
I know a good organization, Black Alliance for Peace,
Yeah,
huh?
that's right.
Yeah,
Black
that's
Alliance for Peace. You thank you. You know what? They would have got me. They said, "Brother, you ain't even do this. You ain't even wrap up right." BlackAllianceForPeace.com, and then we have a U.S. Out of Africa network, which is the organizing arm of our campaign, U.S. Out of Africa Shutdown, AFRICOM, and that this is not just about our. You know what we're doing is not just about U.S. seeing the U.S. but it's also all of imperialism. We know that they're kind of they are one, you know, and that we kind of, you know, we have to understand that the interconnections and complexity of that. And so that's what we're about, Black Alliance for Peace. And we have an Africa team and whatnot. So yeah, thank you for saving me.
Yeah, I don't want you to get the smoke, man. I'm like,
Right.
he's like, yeah, just join the organization. Peace, I'm out of here. I'm like,
Right. And didn't even mention which one, you
you know,
know one?
yeah, which one should we do, you know? Anyway, Nestor Friedman, we appreciate you taking time out. We're
Appreciate
gonna
you too,
take
Brother
a we're
David.
gonna take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
It's Kill.